Welcome back to Russian Roulette, the podcast from the Russia and Eurasia program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. I'm your host, Olga Oleker, here in the CSIS studio with my co-host, Jeffrey Mankoff.
The nicely revamped CSIS studio.
Yes,
hello.
You can't see our studio, but it now has the logos of all of the CSIS podcasts attractively displayed around us. In this episode of Russian Roulette, we sat down with Andrei Bagritsky. Andrei is a consultant at the Pearce Center, a Moscow think tank. He's also a research fellow at the Center for Global Trends and International Organizations of the Diplomatic Academy of the Russian Foreign Ministry, and teaches courses at McGIMO University of the Russian Foreign Ministry. He has been participating in a number of Track 2 working groups on U.S.-Russia strategic relations, including one that we have done here at CSIS on crisis stability, and is a longtime follower and expert on arms control and nonproliferation issues. So we talked to Andrei about Russian approaches to nonproliferation, about Iran and North Korea, about the nonproliferation treaty and its future, and the future of arms control more broadly. Let's get started. Andrei, welcome to Russian Roulette.
Thanks for having me.
So I wanted to take the opportunity of having you here to talk a little bit about how Russian perspectives on nonproliferation, how you go about it, how high a priority it is, differ from American ones. You know, you've been involved with both communities. What do you think are some of the core differences?
Well, I would say that it's an important priority for Russia. If you look at, you know, all of the Russian documents, strategic documents, it's always named as one of the priorities. And, you know, being a nuclear power and being a nuclear superpower, it's one of the things you do. Mm-hmm. It's just you care about nonproliferation.
Why? So, why? Yeah. How does that work?
Yeah, but I mean, that's how it was conceived when there is bipolar order and there are five nuclear weapon states or less. You don't want to get new ones, and you sort of work together on different things, not to make more nuclear weapon states because you just don't want that to happen. And, you know, cases like South African case when we worked together and others, it was something which we did during the Cold War, and also non-proliferation treaty, which was happening against a backdrop of, you know, everything going wrong, the Czechoslovakia thing. But then again, we negotiated and we signed that. So it was always important, and it sort of continues to be, but it depends on specific issues.
So you brought up a couple of examples from the Cold War, which of course was a time when U.S.-Soviet relations were pretty bad, and yet there was this imperative to cooperate on nonproliferation. We're back in a period now where U.S.-Russian relations are also pretty bad, one that often gets compared to the Cold War. So how has that deterioration affected both Russian views of nonproliferation and also U.S.-Russian cooperation around it?
I guess, you know, you have a very clear example of Iran negotiations when the relations were terrible and probably at its worst when after the Ukrainian crisis. And still, Russia participated in negotiating the JCPOA and has been at some points instrumental to negotiating the JCPOA. We can discuss a little bit of what was the reasons for Russia affecting like that, but this effect that the non-proliferation activities did not break down.
Let's come back to discussing the reasons. But yeah.
Sure. But, you know, generally, there's also this... you know, your approach to the severity of the problem. So, for example, Russia never sort of believes that Iran is going to build nuclear weapons. So there were concerns about proliferation of invader things. There were concerns about that Iran will get this latent capability. There were concerns about this Iranian actions would provoke, you know, attack from Israel or from United States, and Middle East will be in calamity. But Russia was never seriously, you know, threatened by a perspective of Iran building nuclear weapons. And, you know, the history shows that Iran didn't build nuclear weapons and wasn't really intending of building them. So from that point of view, you can see that if United States was seriously concerned, that there would be a difference in approaches, right? And if U.S. allies in the region would be more concerned, they would push for that. So I guess it goes by case scenario, and the non-proliferation part is also deeply connected to the, you know, general security part, your relations with the country part, and so on and so forth.
Okay, so, well, since you mentioned the JCPOA, of course, the U.S. has announced its intention to pull out of the agreement. How has that gone over in Russia, and what steps is Russia taking in response?
It didn't go well. I mean, the JCPOA, again, was from the Russian point of view, it was not only a non-proliferation issue, it was a security issue. Because if you remember 2013, there was a clear danger of Israel, you know, trying to take out Iranian nuclear infrastructure, which would mean another war in the Middle East. And Middle East is really not a very stable place. And just to remind you, Iran is a Russian neighbor, we neighbor on Caspian Sea, and it's a big country. And one of the few functioning countries left in the Middle East. So no one really wants Iran to do, you know, to be destroyed. And also, Russia.
Not sure that's true, but
yeah, well, some people would probably. But again, you know, if you don't destroy Iran but you attack Iran, that's a very, you know, good recipe to getting nuclear Iran, because at some point they would say, like, screw, we are building the bomb, whatever you do, and they can do it in underground facilities or whatever. So Russia doesn't want that happening at all. So that was one of the reasons why actually Russia came to negotiate this in the first place. But now with United States withdrawing, there is still a sense in Russia that we can try to save the deal from falling apart. It's waning. You know, it's you can see how from the talks with the people that the possibility of this falling apart is growing. And I would think that if there is no breakthroughs on trade with European Union, if U.S. sanctions are making everybody stop dealing with Iran, then I think that Russia would be probably ready to tolerate some of the, you know, variations from the JCPOA to only make Iran stay within the deal and not cross, you know, a lot of red lines, not to make Israel attack it, because mm-hmm. Russia is also sort of trying to broker between Israel and Iran in the Middle East. So Russia would try to support the JCPOA as long as possible.
So what is the Russian perspective on U.S. approaches to arms control? I mean, one of the things I find is, you know, a constant in U.S.-Russia relations is that both countries' policies make perfectly good sense to themselves, less so lately for the United States, but historically, but are misunderstood by the other and are often, you know, the United States thinks it's doing something in pursuit of goal A, and the Russians see it as actually pursuing goal B, and goal B is nefarious and has something to do with undermining Russia. And you could argue the reverse is true. So does Russia tend to view U.S. non-proliferation policies and plans in that context?
I mean, of course, and it comes back to this whole concept of you don't see just an isolated thing. So United States are heavy-handed, not very interested in other countries' opinions. And when the threat perceptions do not align, it really looks like there might be something nefarious going on.
Like in the case of the Iraq War, for example.
Right. But that was like a strange war anyway.
That was,
Even the Iran thing, like during the 90s, Russia was planning to build a nuclear power plant in Iran, the Bushehr nuclear power plant. So it's a light water reactor. The fuel was planned to be supplied by Russia, taken out by Russia. So it has like not very much of proliferation concern, frankly. But there was huge campaign of pressure on the side of United States, of Israel, not to build anything nuclear related with Iran and in Iran. And for Russia, it was an economic matter because after the Soviet Union collapsed, our nuclear industry wasn't in the best shape. We needed foreign contracts. We needed money to sustain people so they wouldn't, you know, just lose their job. And, you know, there were talks at the time in Israel that maybe we should bomb Bushehr when it's being built and before the completion. So fast forward to 2015, and like everybody sort of agrees that Bushehr has no proliferation concern, zero proliferation concern. No one is talking about bombing it. No one is talking about doing anything with it. So when you look back and say, like, look, what was that all about? So maybe, you know, U.S. and Israel are being disingenuous there, and they just didn't want Russia to be there and Iran to. And we can see examples of that in other spheres as well. So, yes, Russia believes that U.S. actions on non-proliferation are also selective. They also very much dependent on relations between the countries. And, you know, the classic, I keep getting back to Iran because it's things I do. You know, the U.S. had zero problems with the Iranian nuclear program under the Shah. You know, get enrichment, you know, build whatever you want, we'll give you any technology. Like, sure, please, go on, and it's no problem. Once you have Islamic revolution and a new regime, then all of a sudden, hey, there are proliferation concerns. So,
I mean, does Russia not worry slightly more about certain kinds of governments than others?
Yeah, totally. So, yeah, sure. But, I mean, you ask about how it's right. viewed.
I mean, both countries have the proclivity to be selective in their memory and their enforcement priorities, I suppose.
Yeah, unfortunately.
So, of course, the other big non-proliferation question today is surrounding North Korea. And, you know, here Trump and Kim Jong-un recently met, and there was an agreement to pursue denuclearization without being very specific about what that would entail. Is Russia's view of North Korea's nuclear ambitions basically the same as with regard to Iran and other cases, or does it see it somewhat differently?
Well, the big difference is that DPRK has nuclear weapons, while Iran never had and didn't even have a really functioning program to build ones. There is this tendency among the Russian expert community to a certain extent to say, like, well, we don't care about, DPRK's nukes because they're not against us, they're against the United States, so why should we care? When you talk to military people, they say, like, yeah, we are concerned. Like, we don't like nuclear weapon states, probably not really stable at our border. Like, that's not good.
Right.
And, you know, because if you're a military, you have to put on the table all possible scenarios and think how you deal with that. So they are worried. So Russia was always a part of all sorts of formats to deal with this program. And did have total verifiable denuclearization of Korean Peninsula. And there this famous Russian-Chinese proposal of, you know, dual freeze and then going into building this beautiful architecture of peace and security in Northeast Asia.
Mm-hmm. Would that include removing the U.S. nuclear umbrella over South Korea?
I would think so, yes.
Yes. Because you have a beautiful architecture of security. You don't need this anymore.
Because, you know, it's security for all, not only for South Korea. And so when we have this, you know, Kim-Trump summit, which sort of was based on the ideas quid pro quo and, you know, step by step, Russia was fast to, you know, to note that, well, actually they've been implementing the Russian-Chinese scenario all along. I don't sure that Trump and Kim are very interested in building a security architecture in Northeast Asia, though. But, you know, Russia would want to stay in the loop of any future things happening, and that's why there was Lavrov visit, and Kim was invited to come to Moscow and to meet with President Putin, or maybe not Moscow, maybe it will be Vladivostok for the forum, but still. But Russia is sort of, you know, likes the way the things are moving, because when there was really huge military tensions before, that was also like a problem, especially there was this scenario that if United States would be shooting DPRK's missiles, the anti-missiles would be flying, you know, across Russian airspace to hit the PRKs.
Right.
That was like, would be a mess.
Right.
And,
that was something that came up fairly recently. And I think, I mean, I recall there was some surprise from Russian experts that these things didn't have a self-destruct mechanism, that they would actually keep going.
No, yeah, they would.
Right. Well, and also this gets into Russian concerns about ABM systems more generally.
Of course, yeah, because if it, they say that U.S. troops in South Korea are on the table, so it would include probably Assad out of South Korea, which is an irritant for Chinese, and, you know.
Oh, the Fed, yeah.
Yeah, and Russia is also doesn't really like U.S. radars around its borders. So, yeah, if there is a zone of freedom and, you know, democracy and peace-loving in the peninsula and U.S. troops are out, yeah, Russia would be better off with that.
During the Obama administration, the U.S. government put a bit of a premium on nonproliferation issues. There were these nuclear summits. Russia started off participating, but then by the end was out. What's your take on that story? What was driving Russian attitudes towards that format, and what does that say about Russia's attitudes towards multilateral formats more generally?
Right. So I would just maybe clarify. It wasn't non-proliferation per se. It was nuclear security,
right?
Which is sort of slightly different thing,
but related.
Totally. Mm-hmm. But it's more of an, you know, make sure that those nuclear materials wouldn't get in the hands of maybe terrorists or whatever.
Right, which is a proliferation concern, but it's a different kind of proliferation.
Right. So Russia did participate in those when they actually started with Obama and Medvedev and Reset. But as relations were getting better, worse and worse and worse, the last summit Russia declined to go. There was an official, you know, statement from the Russian foreign ministry that basically U.S. and frankly, the more process went on, the less Russia liked the concept because it was from the beginning U.S.-led. U.S. was picking the agenda. U.S. was inviting countries they wanted to invite. They were not inviting countries they didn't want to invite. For example, Iran was never invited despite having a nuclear power plant and significant nuclear facilities. But, you know, U.S. didn't like Iran. So here we go. And I mean, I've heard stories from the Europeans that, you know, some of the Europeans were not invited and they felt that they were, like, left out. So it wasn't only Russian not liking that. But as relations degraded, at some point Russia just decided, you know, we're not going to Obama summit. And it was, like, the last summit anyway. So they were already starting to think how it would look without the summits because the process was over and it was moving to the IAEA, which Russia is much more comfortable with. And they have those IAEA ministerial conferences on nuclear security now, which Russia did go and did participate and had no problem with doing. So I guess at that point, it was partly understanding that there would be a new architecture anyway, and partly not wanting to play along with United States, because Russia... Actually, this is the thing that Rosatom is pushing hard. It's not even the foreign ministry. Is that nuclear security is something which each state does by itself. And this is how it's written in like an IA statute and whatever. So, you know, trying to put on the countries some burden of doing something lacks legal authority, lacks any other authority, and, you know, making other countries do whatever you want is generally not the things Russia likes.
So as a non-proliferation specialist, though, what do you think of that? Because there's a logic to not forcing other countries to do things, but creating a certain amount of peer pressure and potentially a certain amount of support to make sure that the standards are similar because, yes, it's every country's responsibility, but we all potentially suffer if somebody falls down on that responsibility.
It is true, and I mean, it's not a new question, how much are you balancing what each country does with what, you know, generally which country wants to do. And as we've seen, it wasn't always solved in the, you know, this part of doing more, as is very well seen with additional protocol to IAEA safeguards, which countries just don't sign and mm-hmm. don't ratify, and big countries like Argentina and Brazil just say, we are not signing. Mm-hmm. And everybody's saying, like, okay, so
we what can you do? Sovereignty.
We're sort of living with that. I mean, you are right that the more we do in this sense, the better it would be. I guess there's always, again, a balance between if you want to have an inclusive process or if you want to have an effective process. Mm-hmm. So sort of people who are left out wouldn't like it. Mm-hmm. And it might be a bad thing. But also if you're doing it on your own and you bring like-minded countries, it's always, you know, process moves faster and it's more nice to have those kind of summits. I don't know what would be the right way to do, but I mean, there are still so many things to do in nuclear security which are not being done despite the summits, despite mm-hmm. the whatever.
What are some of those things? Like, what are the main priorities?
Yeah, but I mean, like, for example, if you took the nuclear security at IAEA, which is sort of has to help everybody to enhance nuclear security and provide this help, they don't have, they almost don't have a budget. It's mainly voluntary contribution. It's not, you know, part of IAEA budget. So there is this IPAS missions, which is each country can request that IAEA would come examine their system and say, like, look, you can do this and this and this mm-hmm. to enhance your nuclear security. So even that, IAEA does not have, you know, money to provide it to everybody at once. So, I mean...
So resources.
Yeah, like resources and things like countries are not really investing in, and despite this summit process, because summit process was, a lot of it was, you know, rising the awareness and, you know, you get the photo op with US president mm-hmm. for doing some things at home, which is good. I mean, you know, no one would say that bad, but probably more... less ad hoc process, more stable process would be better. And maybe it would be less political controversial, which would be good for everybody in the end. But now, on the current US administration, we don't see any interest in that, mm-hmm. which is actually very surprising because Trump keeps talking about terrorism. Like, terrorism is something, like, everybody agrees is bad. So why not cooperate against nuclear terrorism? Why not sell it as something very sexy and have some initiative on fighting nuclear terrorism?
How worried are you about nuclear terrorism?
Well, yeah.
Because, I mean, I will say I'm not terribly worried about nuclear terrorism. I think this is really hard to do, and I...
Yeah, but that, mm-hmm. that, again...
It's hard to do without state support. I mean, it's one thing to think about, you know... some small group of radicals somewhere getting hold of a nuclear weapon, what would they even do with it? On the other hand, you know, if you have a group like Hezbollah,
you carry it around. Catch. I mean.
But if you frame nuclear security as combating nuclear terrorism, it looks much more sexy and you can, you know, sell
right.
it.
Right. You can sell it to people who are worried about nuclear weapons. You can sell it to people who are worried about terrorism.
Right. No, I mean, I have no problem with strong safeguards and all of these things, but I do
inherit. You know what I mean? Like, it's not only nuclear terrorism. I mean, if you look at radiological sources,
mm-hmm. like dirty bombs,
that's a concern. I mean,
yeah, though, again, it's hard to handle the material. It's hard to manage it. You know, it's a tough thing to operationalize. There are a lot easier ways to create a mass casualty incident.
But probably that would have a lot of, you know, panic effect.
It would.
A big publicity for anybody who does it.
But again, it's really hard. So you could there are easier ways.
Yeah, I mean, you can buy Kalashnikov and shoot people at a stadium. Yeah.
So, Andrei, do you see Russia taking more of a leading role globally on counterterrorism issues, or do you see it kind of stepping back and with this MINATM, it's everybody's own responsibility? Sorry, counterproliferation issues.
I don't see Russia as being a leader on counterproliferation mm-hmm. at all. Russia does not like generally to interfere in other countries' affairs. It sees it as counterproductive. It doesn't normally bring you results you want. So what Russia normally prefers is to organize or to be part of a coalition, preferably within the Security Council and have all the legal authority. That's where Russia gets comfortable with doing things internationally, unless this is point of, you know, mm-hmm. special concern where Russia can act unilaterally. But so maybe if Ukraine would be building nuclear weapons, that would be a point of concern for Russia. But, you know, Myanmar not, you know, doing everything which is has to do according to its safeguards agreements would be a point of concern, but not, you know, urgent priority. So, yeah, more participating in a wider mechanism, not probably acting unilaterally.
You took part in a working group that we were running here at CSIS on crisis stability. And we've got the link to that, the report from that working group in the show notes, also the papers that were written. But I'd like you to weigh in a little bit on, you know, we talked about a lot of things, both nuclear and conventional. I mean, the whole idea was to think about how you keep crises from escalating. From a Russian perspective, what did you learn from having those conversations about U.S. perspectives? You spent a lot of time talking to Americans, so I doubt anything surprised you, but perhaps there's something that you think really needs to be brought home to Moscow.
Yeah, I mean, a couple of things which you don't get from just reading newspapers or... and they're probably not that much connected to crisis stability. The one thing is that how different are, you know, threat perceptions. And generally, you know, the whole idea that, you know, escalate to de-escalate, for example, is a thing. It's really remote in Moscow. You can conceptualize that people really think this is real. People really think that Russia is doing this because, I mean, it's not a big topic in Russia anyway, but even if you read those articles, you see, like, do they mean this? Do they don't know the facts? Do they, like, what's the issue? You come here and you see that people really care about it and really invested about that. And also, for example, the issue about the Russia and the Baltics. So, you mean, generally in Russia, there is no too much concern over the Baltics. Russia is not very interested in the Baltics. There is not too much going on there anyway. And if you talk to the, you know, people from the Baltics, experts from the Baltics, they'll say, like, yeah, I mean, probably Russia is not occupying us tomorrow. And the things they would really care is that, you know, the relationship between Russia and the West are getting lower and lower. And, you know, they would be getting a problem because of that, not because of some specific Russian interest in the Baltics. But then you come to those sorts of meetings and people are really afraid that Russia would be invading the Baltics or they would really, you know, go for this...
it's all about the Suwalki Gap.
Suwalki Gap, right. Yeah. It's like, really, like Suwalki Gap. And yeah, it was interesting to talk to some Europeans and they're like, have you been to Suwalki Gap? It's like there's nothing there. It's like forests and swamps. It's not very, you know, good for moving.
Can't get a bunch of tanks through it, is that what
you're saying? No, not really. So it's very interesting to see that things you were reading and, you know, hearing about, people really believe in this and really care about this. And this is actually an interesting takeaway that maybe Russia should do something about it. Maybe Russia should come to people and explain more and talk about this more because people are really concerned. And in Moscow, it's, a lot of times it's just dismissed as, you know, they are inventing excuses for being mad at us or this Russophobia or whatever. Yeah. But, I mean, it's a real concern.
Yeah, but does Russia benefit from that kind of, I don't know, paranoia in some ways, though?
If you're playing three-dimensional chess, then maybe you are benefiting. But Russia generally wants to have good relations with the West. Russia wants to sanctions to be lifted. Russia wants to trade with everybody and get investments and technology and whatever. So, you know, we have a World Cup currently, which 25,000 Americans are coming, and which was really hard to get tickets back because, like, all are bought by the U.S., football fans or soccer fans in your case. So, you know, Russia is still part of this global system, which now is in some ways, you know, closed and in some ways broken, but it's still part of this. And Russia would frankly want everybody just accept its, you know, approach to the world and live with it and have beautiful relations ever
and leave
after.
It alone.
No, I mean, like, no, engage with it, but in a good sense.
Yeah.
Another question, how feasible is that? But so Russia doesn't really need Baltics to fear invasion in order to, you know, do whatever. That's my view.
So I mean, I think there's the flip side of this, which is the irrational beliefs that Russians have about American policy, right?
Totally.
And you mentioned one of them in the event we did to launch the Crisis Stability Report, which is this belief that the Americans plan a bolt from the blue attack on with conventional weapons on Russian nuclear forces.
Because why you have so many conventional weapons?
Exactly. Why do you have so many non-strategic nuclear weapons? Why do you have so many conventional weapons?
Back and forth and back and forth.
No, but and I think the missile defense conversation is a very similar one.
Yeah.
And the United States arguably has tried to go to Russia and explain, no, that's not what we mean, and that's not worked. I mean, on missile defense, certainly. Right. On the bolt from the blue, I think it's less understood that that's a perception.
I think on the missile defense issue, part of the problem was that the U.S. itself was of more than one mind about what it was ultimately for. And, you know, if you're sitting in Moscow, you can sort of pick and choose which interlocutor you want to listen to.
Right. Well, and the same thing happens when Americans watch Russian strategic debates,
And this is exactly, I think, what happened with this escalate to de-escalate notion. Like, there were Russian commentators writing about this at one point, and people in the West.
In 1999.
Yeah, well.
And there's some people who are still
writing.
And people in the West seized on that and say, well, look, even if it's not in Russia's nuclear doctrine. Somebody's thinking about it.
Right, and somebody is. People are always thinking about all sorts of things.
Totally. And the job of military planners is to prepare for worst-case scenarios, and
which
that's
sometimes
what they do.
Is counterproductive when it gets out of hands. So, yeah, it's a good point that, you know, those things are not really tractable. But
no, I'm just wondering what the way forward – I mean, you say you come away with it with a sense that maybe we should – you know, try harder to explain to the Americans that, no, that's not what we're doing. I wonder if a better solution is to explain to Russians, yes, the Americans really think this, so we have to adapt our policy to the fact that they think this and we're probably not going to talk them out of it. And I would argue the same is true for the United States in dealing with Russia, that we're not going to convince them that we're right and they're wrong. We might be able to define policies that mitigate some of their threat perception.
In other words, we should try diplomacy.
We should try diplomacy.
I would add to that that, I mean, you're right. It's very important to understand that those people really have those opinions. That they're not just, you know, lying or, you know, coming up with something. And it's sometimes really counterintuitive, and it's hard to believe that people would believe crazy things, right?
Right.
Or things we believe to be crazy, which make total sense for them. So that's one thing. The second thing would probably be to do all possible, you know, explanation so that people who are not interested or could be, you know, in between would get at least the information.
Right.
So not you know, they have this one-sided discussion. Third thing is, you have diplomacy and we talk and have to start with that, like, we accepted this and we accept this. Can we, like, do something while accepting both of these things?
Right.
And,
yeah.
Like, overarching.
We hold these completely incompatible viewpoints.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's put
that
aside. Let's accept that.
And then think. And that's actually sometimes frustrating when you come to those sorts of meetings because, you know, for first day, people just exchange, their views of what.
Talk past each other.
Yeah. And then you, like, on day two, you're, okay, we established that these people believe this and these people believe this. Could have just started with that and.
I think that's what we need to be doing more and more of is just recognizing that these positions exist and moving forward.
Yeah, I agree. So we've been talking about non-proliferation with regard to third countries. But, of course, there's also a lot of concerns about nuclear security, disarmament, arms control, just in the bilateral U.S.-Russia context. So maybe we should talk about that for a minute, too. We have the NPT review conference coming up here soon. How do you assess the positions of U.S. and Russia ahead of that conference? How is the whole regime holding up?
On July 1, we'll be having the 50th anniversary of signature of NPT. It was opened for signature. And in 2020, we'll be having the review conference, which will be the anniversary. It's 50 years since the first one, since the first review conference in 1970. So those, you know, round numbers are always a time when you can reflect on how it's going. And it's not going particularly well. And part of it is that non-nuclear weapon states and nuclear weapon states are still fighting because one believes that others are not disarming fast enough, which was like, which they've been fighting since the signing of the NPT. But the other thing is that nuclear weapon states are not, you know, united anymore. And it used to be the case, again, even during hard times. We managed to come up with a joint statement of P5.
That everyone agreed that, arms control was basically a good idea.
Well, but we were holding on to our nuclear weapons nonetheless.
Yeah, we weren't going to give them all up, but we were willing to.
We're working towards full disarmament. Working towards.
At least doing something. So the Chinese made a glossary of nuclear terms, which was in five languages. It was fine. It's not even that anymore. The last preparatory committee, which was in Geneva this spring, they didn't come up with a joint communique. So because of Russian and U.S. Bitter relations, and even more than that, like I was following the discussion of the review conference, and it was like, at some point, is this Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty Review Conference? Because everybody's talking about chemical weapons because of, you know, Syria and the Skripal case. So you see this huge flooding of, you know, the issues which are not the core of the discussion coming in and, you know, preventing anybody from meaningful dialogue. So we might as well, and we have no progress on any front on arms control or disarmament, so we have nothing to show to other countries. So, we can totally see how in 2020 we again are not having any final document, and countries more and more disillusioned with the whole process. And they have this treaty, the Bern Treaty, Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, which was opened for signature last September, and or it was late August or last September. Now it has something like 12 countries ratified it, not too much, but you know, it's moving in that direction, and it's again a big irritant for both United States and Russia, and also probably not complicated things to come up with some sort of conclusion. So it's very messy and very complicated, and you know, the NPT is like a really good treaty. Everybody thinks that it should be there, and it's a balance between which everybody wants, but again, which everybody can get. But the implementation of the treaty, and especially those, you know, views on the treaty and how it should work, are getting more and more divergent over time.
I mean, it's a good treaty because it lets everybody say that they're on the same page and agree, even though they don't, right? The nuclear weapon states don't really want to commit to disarming, and the non-nuclear weapon states really would like them to. Like many good treaties, it's based on everybody being
based
able
on
to
fudge.
Being able to lie to themselves a little bit. And you know, part of the reason for the frustration of the non-nuclear weapon states is it's been a long time and they're sick of it.
It's been 50 years, and well,
I think the inability of the nuclear weapon states to come to an agreement is, it's differently interesting because they agree on everything to do with the NPT. They disagree with the non-nuclear weapon states, but their position has not in any way changed over the course of all this time. So,
well, with a caveat that I think the current administration in the United States is perhaps less committed to the goal of disarmament as a principle than any of its predecessors.
Well, so nobody was committed to the goal of disarmament.
Well, they weren't committed to full disarmament, but they were committed to...
Absolutely, of reductions. Yes. Reductions. Yeah. No, I think that's possibly true.
The caveat again is that you can, before, you could always say, like, look, we signed this New START treaty, we went to 100-500, and, you know, here we go, we are disarming. What else do you want? Now we don't have too much of the success stories.
We're fulfilling the New START treaty.
Right, but in 2020 review conference, we might be at a point where there'll be no more New START treaty and INF might be dead at that point.
Right.
Which would be even harder to explain to everybody how are we actually
contributing
to disarmament.
Yeah, so, no, that would be awkward.
I don't have a good answer to that.
No, a lot of people don't have a good answer to that. So, yeah, unless something happens if there's a breakthrough with DPRK, for example, which can be showcased as look. Mm-hmm. And yeah, JCBY is gone, which was also like one of the things yes. which everybody was saying,
success story.
Look, non-proliferation is working. So yeah, if not for DPRK, I guess there is no viable alternatives because CTBT US mm-hmm. is not interested, FMCT is not moving very well. So I don't know.
It's a bad time for arms control.
Yeah.
And non-proliferation.
And non-proliferation. Yeah. Andre, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
All right, that is it for our show today. Thank you for joining us again. There's a link to Andre's bio and some of his publications in the show notes. You can also find there the recent CSIS report on U.S.-Russian crisis stability.
And also the event where we launched that report where Andre was speaking.
Now, for those of you who haven't, you should subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and leave us a rating and review as well. If you're not an iTunes user, you can check us out and subscribe on Google Play or SoundCloud. And once again, keep spreading the word.
In addition to spreading the word, if you have questions, if you have concerns, if there are things you want us to talk about on Russian Roulette, send us a mailbag question. Send it via email to rep@csis.org with the words Russian Roulette in the subject line. We look forward to hearing from you. You can also follow the program on Twitter at CSIS Russia, and you can follow us on Twitter. I'm at Olya Oliker, and Jeff is at Dr. J. Mankoff.
And, of course, big thank you once again to everyone who works so hard to make the podcast happen every 2 weeks. That includes our research assistant and program coordinator, Cyrus Newland, our intern, Kimberly Schuster, and the whole CSIS External Relations and iLab team. Until next time.
Thank you for listening.